pleasure. This is going to be a fun time. It's a little bit of a different type of talk because basically I'm going to provide you with some background on oceanic spreading center processes. We're going to go the gamut here. We're going to go from geology. We're going to talk a little bit about hydrothermal venting. I'm going to touch on biology and a little bit of chemistry, but it's all going to be very brief, just trying to give you a sense of what oceanic spreading center is about and why it is that this group is going up to the Gackle today. Because they do have a first-time opportunity to actually get down onto the seafloor for the first time in this area. Okay, oceanic spreading centers. Many of you will know, but for those that are not familiar, there's a section here, the Juan de Fuca Ridge, runs down the East Pacific Rise here, runs all the way between the Pacific Plate and the Antarctic, up into the Indian Ocean, coming across the picture, and of course, the Mid-Atlantic Ridge here. And what you see, many of these pictures that I'm showing here, are the exotic life forms that are found in certain areas along the ridge. We actually don't know where all they are. We're finding that the closer and closer we look, the more often we do find these hydrothermal vent systems. But what I'm trying to point out in this slide is a rather exciting thing. You can see that there are different ocean basins here between the Atlantic Basin, separate from the... Thank you. The Atlantic Basin, separate from the Pacific Basin, and the area that we'll be looking at today, the Arctic Basin, is a completely separate area. In fact, it's even off the top of this map. But one of the questions we have in oceanic spreading centers is, does the fact that a given basin has been isolated for a long period of time, does that affect the ecosystem? Are there different biological communities, different components of the biological ecosystems because of that isolation? And so those are some of the questions that are very interesting. And that's why there's these puzzle pieces in this particular slide. There's a few key areas that scientists are trying to investigate. So today, we're going to be zooming in on one of those areas. How do we find hydrothermal vents? Typically, when we're in the open ocean, we're able to tow vehicles. And so we can use a system. Here now is a vehicle that has many sensors on it. One of the sensors would be a temperature sensor that would be attached to the wire, and in fact, you might put a string of sensors on that wire. You put the vehicle over the side, and you move the ship along, and basically each of these sensors is picking up a measurement for you. So that's nice in the open ocean, but picture now we're going up to the Arctic where it's ice-covered. We can't just tow something like that. We can barely even necessarily count on the forward progress of the ship, and so we need a different approach. Now, what the groups have done that have been up in the Arctic before is they have taken a CTD system and they've just lowered it down in one point, brought it back up, moved the ship, made a hole in the ice, lowered it down and brought it back up. So that's where we have data from before. But you can see that it's going to be a slower process. If you look in at this slide here, the gray shade you can probably just barely make out is the shape of the seafloor along a particular transect of mid-ocean ridge. And in this case, they were able to do this tow-yo, up, down, while the ship is towing the CTD, and they could make a map here, and the colors are indicating where, in this case, backscatter of light, because there were particles in the water because of hydrothermal plumes, they found a concentration there. When they measured temperature at the same location, they found slightly higher temperatures there. So by doing this towed mapping, they could zoom in and say, ah, this is an area that we ought to send video imagers down to the seafloor, and let's actually go have a look. When you are able to zoom into the seafloor, so this would be a next step in the process, you can send a remotely operated vehicle, or in the Arctic, we'll send an autonomous vehicle, and one with a sonar system. And now here, this is 200 meters, so we've expanded the scale. We're really zooming in on one part of the spreading axis, and we're finding shallow areas in yellow, deeper areas in blue, and we're getting a sense of what that detailed shape of the seafloor looks like. And when you put this area in perspective view, you can probably just barely make out these areas. There's actually mounds or high points in the shape of the seafloor. And it turns out that some of these mounds are, in fact, hydrothermal vents. So here now we're looking at a few meters across. And here we're showing vents. If you can see carefully, and I'll show you a better picture, there's actually some of these limpets and barnacles of the ecosystem right here on the black smoker. And there's fluids coming out of these vents here. So these are the hydrothermal systems that they would like to see in the Arctic. This happens to be a case where we did nested studies in the Western Pacific. Here now we're zooming right into the ridge axis. So we're just looking at a few kilometers across here, about 10 kilometers across and about 10 kilometers deep. And so we're zooming in. We've got the hot magma coming up from below. It pools for a period of time in a magma chamber. It begins to crystallize in part, but some of it is still very molten, and some of it can erupt actually to the seafloor. And so you end up with a layer, and this is the crustal layer that has a different composition from the mantle peridotite below. And here showing the illustration of the seawater circulating within the crust, coming down here, heating up, and then it would vent out somewhere along the ridge axis. So seismology has indicated that overall, the thickness of the crustal layer all around the globe is about the same. And this was an idea that we'd had up until about 10 years ago. Oh, oceanic crust is pretty similar wherever you go. But what we're finding in about the past decade or so is that the closer we look at mainly the slow spreading systems, we're finding that rather than being a really consistent, steady layer of thickness of this basalt extruded and gabbro intruded, at slow spreading systems, we tend to get smaller intrusions of magma. There's probably less magma available because the plates aren't pulling apart as far. The melt is not as rapidly produced. So you get small intrusions of magma. Some of them never make it. Sometimes there's never any extrusion. There may not be at a basalt layer. Or maybe the intrusion is up near the surface. And so it's this kind of crust that we're trying to understand in the Arctic Ridge. We're pretty sure. It's a question. We don't know. So zooming in a little bit, and here this is now a case from the Northeast Pacific, the Juan de Fuca Ridge, and it's the Endeavor segment. And so this is the same type of picture I was just showing you, and it's just trying to zoom in where we've got the magma here, upflow of hydrothermal fluid into a particular zone, a lot of chemical precipitation in this area, but then the major chimneys up at the top. And this chimney here, it would be just one example. What would happen is you would have a group of chimneys, like is shown here. You would have a group here, a couple kilometers further up the ridge axis, you would have another group. And there would be circulation of seawater, somewhere down in the middle of those two fields and then coming up at the two fields on either side. And so this is showing now some tube worms, some instrumentation where they're trying to take water samples and do long-term measurements at this system on the Endeavor vent field. We, at the East Pacific Rise, this is part of the Ridge 2000 program, we have an opportunity to document what happens when you have an eruption on the seafloor. How do these systems evolve? And this is work that's going on right now because there was a recent eruption. In 2005 and 2006, there was a lava eruption on the seafloor there. Now, we didn't actually get to film the eruption going on, but here we are. So this is the location here off of Mexico. Here's Mexico running down here. Here's the East Pacific Rise. We're zooming in on a map of a few kilometers across, showing that we had ocean bottom seismometers down on the seafloor. When we went out to go recover them, some of them didn't come back. They were talking to us acoustically. We knew they were there. We knew they were still alive, so the instruments hadn't died, but they didn't come surface to the sea surface. Turns out that they were stuck in lava. And if you can see this picture here, here's one of those ocean bottom seismometers. It's about this big around. It's stuck in shiny black new lava. Now, I don't know if it was this particular one. They actually were able to go back and retrieve a couple of these by digging them out with an ROV. But it's very exciting because for the first time, here now we're looking at time over about a year's worth of time, and we're looking at the buildup of number of earthquakes over time, and we can see a rapid buildup of earthquakes and then a rapid drop-off. And this is classic. This is the same kind of thing that happens at Mount St. Helens. As you have magma intruding, there's a buildup of seismic activity. Once the the eruption happens, then the stresses have dropped, and you have a drop of activity. So here I'm just showing you the geophysical data, the biological data of what was there before and how it's changing with time with the new eruption, because this is a community that was there before the eruption. And so here's an opportunity to say, oh, that community was disturbed. How long does this chimney take to get re-inhabited? How does this system evolve? So it's a very exciting time. Okay, now we're going to move to the Atlantic very briefly, and I'm going to start heading us towards the Yakel Ridge. And this is a place where instead of basalt being exposed right at the seafloor, in fact, there was very little magmatism, we think. We're still trying to understand the models. And so, in fact, it was only mantle rock. Serpentinized peridotite was exposed at the seafloor. And so this is all showing the rock that was exposed at the seafloor a few kilometers off the axis. We weren't right in the spreading axis here. And we discovered in 2000 large carbonate chimneys, about 180 feet tall. These things were huge. And the white here are microbial, just dense microbial systems where there's active venting going on. pH is much higher at these systems than it is at the black smoker systems. So completely different. And as you can see here, there is some macrofauna. They don't happen to show up in these pictures. But it's much less densely populated by macrofauna. It's the microfauna, or the microbial systems, the microorganisms, that are so important here. So here, just zooming in. And this is some exciting work. And I have a website at the end, Deb Kelly and her group. She was with us in 2000, and she's carried on here, of just some beautiful high-definition images of these hydrothermal vents here. And these are, you know, we're looking at many, many meters here. This is a few meters here. So we're not seeing the whole chimney, but these are large systems and quite exotic. Again, just some images. Now, down here in the right, I'm trying to show you a cartoon of what the crustal, the plates are pulling apart here. Here's the axis of spreading. And this blue would be the typical magmatic crust, gabbro and basalt. And the idea, before we went out here with the drill ship to try and ground truth this, our model was that, oh, so we've had a period of time, very little magma intrusion, and so mainly the mantle itself was being uplifted along this fault and exposed right at the seafloor. And that's why we were having hydrothermal activity right here. But we went out there in 2004, 2005. I spent 4 months out in the middle of the Atlantic and with the drilling ship, and we recovered 1.5 kilometers of rock, and here's one section that happens to be a couple meters high. She's a little bit shorter than I am, but it's still a nice, beautiful piece of core from the middle of the Atlantic. And we were surprised. We did not come back with a bunch of serpentinized peridotite. We came back with mainly a gabbroic sequence. And we were drilling a few kilometers north of the Lost City. We didn't want to drill right in the hydrothermal system. We didn't want to disturb that system. But as you can see here, this is now the shallow, mountain range. This is the axis of the spreading center. We were drilling just a few kilometers away, and it's basically still in the dome. So as far as we knew, we should have been drilling in the same type of stuff that the Lost City is in. So this basically, the drilling, the ground truth, forced us to change our models. And I just have a second here to try and show you what we think maybe a better model would be. So now I'm showing you, this is now where we're trying to illustrate a cartoon of what would be going on if we look at a cross-section through the Atlantis Massif here and across the spreading axis. Here's the spreading axis. Atlantis Massif in this time hasn't formed yet, but we're postulating that maybe the way Atlantis Massif forms is that you have more magmatism than usual for a period of time, and then as time evolves down here, you have a fault cut through. The position of the fault is guided around the edges of the gabbro body, and with time, that gabbro body gets uplifted. But you end up with a sheath, just a thin layer of serpentinized peridotite around the edges of the gabbro body. So our new model is that the Lost City, now if we were to do the, we're doing the profile this way now, but if we did the profile this way, it would be the same picture, a thin sheath coming over that southern wall. And so our postulation is that if we drilled right at Lost City, we would eventually go through to gabbro. Now, the reason I'm presenting this model now is that the same questions can be asked in the Arctic systems. It's an interesting place to see what's going on. So now, the Arctic. I've been talking about the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. If you run up the Mid-Atlantic through Iceland, north of Iceland, past Svalbard, here's the Gackel Ridge at last. With 2 minutes left to spare, I'm going to show you what's been done at the Gackel Ridge, and then we're going to go to the Gackel Ridge Live and talk to the scientists there. Okay, Gackel. Now we're zooming in. We're up. Here's the North Pole right here. Here's Greenland, North America here, Russia around here. So the crews that left, they left the northern parts of Norway, and they're working up in the Gackel Ridge here. And here's, in fact, is an image of the ship that they're on, the Odin, an icebreaker. But what are the? Why might I think that the Gackel Ridge might have similarities with the Mid-Atlantic? If we look at spreading rates, so how fast the plates are pulling apart, you can see that both the Mid-Atlantic Ridge and the Gackel Ridge are down at around a couple centimeters per year compared to these other systems that are much faster. We have some previous knowledge of what the shape of the seafloor is at the Gackel. One, the Navy's been up there a lot, but we don't usually have access to the data. But some scientists in 1998 and 1999 did have access to one of the nuclear submarines, and it was a scientific, open, unclassified expedition. So they mapped the bathymetry, and the shape of the bathymetry is rather similar to what we've seen in the Atlantic in places. So here's a map showing that. So now here's the Gackel Ridge running up here, And each of these sections, we're going from A is here, B, C, and D. So moving up like this. And you can see deep rift valleys, but occasional volcanic ridges, a lot of relief in some places. And what I'm showing you here is the rocks that have been sampled in the past. The red are basalts. So here we are at this ultra-slow spreading center, but they've in fact sampled many, many basalts. So at least sun magnetism is going on. We know that by the fact that they got basalts. But there are sections along here where peridotite has been sampled right at the seafloor, and peridotite would be the mantle rock. So those would be places, and this is what the group up there postulate, that there's been very little magmatic intrusion in that area. So they would expect that the hydrothermal systems here would be different than here. And so that's what they're after to go check. Now, what they know about the hydrothermal systems so far is shown here. So now this is, again, a slightly different map, but it's all the same section of the Gackle that's showing up here. And this is showing where they've done CTDs, and this was back in 2001, I guess, the Amore cruise. And this was a multidisciplinary cruise where many people went out for 3 months or something. And they just put CTDs down and looked for plumes in the water column, so it's still remote. And you can see these red symbols here are indicating some backscatter, but the largest ones are showing quite a bit. And so this is where they have more confidence that there's probably hydrothermal vent fields. And so they've indicated that with yellow stars here. And that's the same positions there. So it's these locations that the group on the Odin are trying to target. And they're going to send in a series of more detailed instruments. So I'm going to show you briefly a quick look at who's out there. This is Rob Sohn. Rob actually was a graduate student here at Scripps. He's acting as the chief scientist on the cruise. He's now at Woods Hole. This is Hanu Singh. He's done a lot of the design and building of the instruments that they're going to use. Tim Shank is a biologist out there. He's done a lot of work in other ridges, so he's got a lot of background expertise. Susan Humphreys is a geochemist. Here I'm showing her working with some rock samples of chimneys from a different cruise. Hedy Edmonds, and I think this is who we'll be talking with today, and that's maybe her. She's a chemist, and so her main interest is the hydrothermal vent fluid chemistry. And then we have an oceanographer, somebody who's keeping track just temperature, salinity, currents in the ocean. Okay, I believe we've got the Odin on the line here, so we're going to be switching them on.
Hello from the iceberg Odin at 85 North. This is Chris Linder from the Life in the Folds project, and I have with me on the line Dr. Hedy Edmonds from the University of Texas at Austin. She's the lead chemist on this trip, and she's also very important link to the past. She was on the 2001 expedition to the Arctic that found the first evidence for hydrothermal vents on the Gackle Ridge. So without further ado, I guess I'll open this up for questions to Hedy.
I'll just interject and say hi, too.
What are you finding in the way of vent activity and chemistry near them?
Well, what we've been able to do so far, we set out to go to two of the sites where I found evidence for activity 6 years ago. And we're at the first of those sites now. And we were able to relocate the signals that we saw in 2001, which was a relief. And we've done a good job of delineating, sort of mapping out the plume to give the AUVs a target to dive on. And that dive, that first dive, is supposed to happen tonight.
In order to keep the instrumentation stationary over the vent you want to study, how do you do station keeping with an icebreaker in drifting ice?
That is an excellent question. And the basic answer is we don't. In fact, we were able to make use of that in mapping the plume with the CTD instrument. Normally what we do in open water is our first step in trying to map the plume would be what we call a toyo, where we drive the ship at a half a knot or maybe a knot with the CTD in the water, and we yo-yo it down to get a section through the plume. And you can't, you really can't drive the ship when you have something over the side in the ice. I'm always worried about ice cutting a wire or pinning a wire. But what we did this time was try to get a sense of how the ship was drifting, and that changes over the course of the day. But if we could get a pretty good prediction, we could actually try to drift across the plume and yo-yo up and down and do some mapping that way. With the AUVs, we don't want to drift so far away that we can't hear the vehicle anymore. But we also can't have the ship's engines running, or we won't be able to hear the vehicle. So what we'll do probably is, if we drift out of range, put a transducer on the ship's helicopter. It'll fly out to an open lead and listen for the vehicle while the ship then drives back into range. And then we'll shut the ship down and listen again from the ship. So it'll be kind of an iterative process.
This sounds somewhat nerve-wracking, but exciting at the same time.
And it's one of the frustrating but interesting things about working up here. One of the problems I had in 2001 was that when I had an opportunity to do a CTD cast, I couldn't necessarily do it where I wanted to. Sometimes the ice just wouldn't let you get there, and other times the ice doesn't let you stay there.
Have the weather and ice conditions been what you expected, or have you run into things that were unexpected or particularly challenging? Did I get that right? Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say it's pretty much what we predicted. I haven't been up here at this exact time of year, and I think, based on my previous experience, I'm finding the ice at this site relatively easy to deal with. We haven't had really strong winds. Things haven't really been sort of bashing into each other and making it difficult for the ship to get where we want to be. I expect it to get a little bit more difficult as we go further east, sort of out into the central Arctic, but so far so good.
Yep, take it when it's good. We had another question over here.
To follow along with that, what is the condition of the ice in which you find yourself? Are there a lot of leads, or is it pretty solid?
It's really interesting. It comes and goes over the course of the day. I hadn't realized the extent to which there's a tidal effect on the movement of the ice. And so what we find is that for part of the day, everything kind of compresses in, and then on the other side of the tidal cycle, it'll open up a little bit. As for thickness, the ice is between 1 and 2 meters thick.
So more of the annual pack ice than the real heavy main stuff at this point.
Yeah. We're not looking at the big multi-year ice flows with huge pressure ridges in between them. The other thing I find interesting is, being on this ship versus the Healy, 6 years ago, the Odin has a very different way of breaking ice. It kind of rides up on top of it and uses its weight to break through. And my sense is that we've done a lot less backing and ramming, or at least when Healy did it, it was more of a brute force thing, and you felt the whole ship sort of slam into an ice flow.
Is that a cultural approach, perhaps?
Could be. This is definitely a more elegant ride.
Yeah, that sounds good. And it maybe the year is a little different, too. But okay. Well, Hetty, any parting words for us?
Oh, boy.
Put you on the spot.
Stay tuned. This is really exciting. And I think within the next couple of days, we're going to take off for a place that I think most of us have most wanted to go for a long time.
That's great. I'm glad this has worked out. I know you've been dying to get up there ever since you saw the plume. So we'll be sitting here. I, anyway, have been watching the website, and I think I'll certainly be sending this group there so they can follow from here, too. But Thanks so much for giving us a call, and best of luck with the continued operations.
Thanks.
But just in summary, we're talking about oceanic spreading centers here. These are places where the tectonic plates are spreading. Basaltic magma, so a different composition than the background mantle, is rising to form new oceanic crust. Older crust that was there before is being faulted, and the magma is intruding, slowly crystallizing to gabbro, or perhaps extruding, erupting right onto the seafloor as basalt. The hydrothermal vents, due to seawater circulation, emit hot, mineral-laden fluids. That seawater has picked up the fluids from the crust, so we're having transfer of chemical exchange between the solid earth and the oceans in this case. And the fluid and chimney compositions are going to depend on what crustal rock type is exposed there at the seafloor. So we've seen that there can be more than one rock type. The chemosynthetic ecosystems that thrive in this extreme environment. They have symbiotic relationships between the microorganisms and the macrofauna. At Black Smokers, it's mainly an iron sulfide dominant system. Temperatures can get up as high as 300 degrees. There's definitely is boiling in those systems. At the peridotite or mantle rock-hosted systems, the chimneys tend to be carbonate. pH is quite high. Temperatures are lower. 100 degrees is about the hottest that we've seen so far. So it's a significantly different system. And then finally, to wrap up, as we've just been seeing here, the recently developed autonomous, in some cases remotely operated vehicles, have been a huge aid to the investigation. They're really pushing us forward. We're much more rapidly being able to get to understand these systems. When we do these nested studies where we start out with the large scale, you know, from a surface ship and then maybe CTDs into the water column, then we zoom in with a sort of moderate, intermediate scale sonar system, and then we zoom in with the imagery, it's really an efficient way to go. So we're discovering things quite fast. And in this case, at the Gackle Ridge, we're, for the first time, being able to study a system that we've never been able to with that video image before. So what I'll leave up here and open it up to questions from you is just a series of websites. And I did want to, none of us mentioned so far, this whole program here, the Gackle Ridge, is one of several expeditions that are part of the International Polar Year. This is something that happened back in, I believe it was 1958 or so, and it's something that's been, we're redoing it right now. And so it's more than a year, actually, to encompass field seasons on either side for both poles. And there's a lot of activities of a whole variety, geology, biology, sociology, going on with the International Polar Year. So you can go to a website there. Ridge, mid-ocean ridge systems in general, you can go to the Ridge 2000 system, and that's part of what we're hosting here at Scripps with the Ridge program. And then, of course, the Polar Discovery. And you can go, there's a journal-style series of slideshows that you can go through. And from today forward, I would recommend you may want to follow that site and find out, did they actually find those critters down at the vents on the Yakel yet, or are we still looking?